Welcome to Inspired. I'm Amber Khan. This week marks the federal holiday to commemorate the birth of civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This year, he would have been 91 years old. Many of his quotes circulating on social media are universal messages and often attributed to just Dr. King, not the Reverend Doctor. And it's that part of his title that's a subtle reminder that his quest for social justice was deeply rooted in his Christian faith. While he was not secular and he rejected exclusivism, Dr. King built a multi-faith coalition that included friendships and alliances with Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist communities. He often referenced Mahatma Gandhi and the Gandhi Doctrine of Nonviolence. Now, this all comes through in his sermons, not in the soundbite versions, but the hour-long ones. They echo his theology of liberation that reject the vestiges of what Frederick Douglass called the slaveholder religion. That's where Bible passages were invoked to justify paternalistic racial subjugation, white supremacy, and segregation. In contrast, the Reverend Dr. King's messages return to the redemptive power of love in the face of oppression and hate.
What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love.
But for those only familiar with the Cliff Notes version of Dr. King, there might be some surprises.
It's a person folks think they know, but really if they knew King and the radical King, they might not be so quick to quote him these days. He well recognized that there has to be more than, I think it was Ella Baker who said, more than a hamburger. It's more than about integrating lunch counters at Woolworths. It's about more than being able to go and sit in the same movie theater. It's about actually sharing and distributing power and resources that have been very unequally distributed throughout the history of the United States.
That's Jamar Tisby. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Mississippi, where he studies race and religion in the 20th century. A year ago, he wrote The Color of Compromise, the truth about the American church's complicity in racism. And since hitting the bookshelves, it's been an Amazon bestseller in Christian church and Bible history and was named 2019 Book of the Year by the Englewood Review of Books. The provocative subtitle, The American Church's Complicity in Racism, doesn't pull any punches. And that's where our conversation starts. That is a provocative title.
Yes, it is. But it's a provocative subject. The book does a historical survey looking at the American church's failure, really, in so many instances to confront racism and even unearth the truths that have been hidden or muted or muffled from the past.
Hidden, muted, or muffled. This week's show, we explore the people, stories, and relationships that have either faded or been flattened by the Cliff Notes version of the civil rights movement. From mainline churches to women of color to the experiences of being both African American and Jewish. To understand all of this, according to Tisby, a clear-eyed recollection is key. Let's get back to my conversation. Who is this book for?
This book is for people of faith, particularly Christians. And if you really want to narrow it down, it comes out of my experiences working with, speaking to, serving white Christians who are theologically conservative, as well as black Christians who understand there's an issue but want more data and more specifics behind it to try to help explain it to others.
Tisby is not just a religious historian. He has a master's in divinity and often preaches in pulpits that are conservative and predominantly white.
I remember preaching about against racism in a sermon one Sunday at a Presbyterian church, and most of the people came up and thanked me and you know, said, "We're glad you spoke here. Come on back again." But there was one person, a taller white male, who that's important because he sort of used his physical presence to intimidate me. He gets really close to me, kind of towers over me, and basically says, "I didn't preach the gospel." And he's like red in the face and almost trembling with rage. And in that moment, I could respond very calmly because I knew whatever he was responding to was way more than a sermon that I had just preached. There was way more baggage there. But what also got me was no one intervened. Not the assistant or associate pastor nearby, not the other parishioners. It just happened. And that to me is sort of a picture of complicity.
Jamar Tisby doesn't use the word evangelical to describe himself, even though many conservatively Christian African Americans align theologically with evangelicals. The word itself doesn't resonate in the Black community.
I'm always one of a few people of color and one of the very few Black people in those settings. So I'm constantly aware through personal experience of what it's like to be a minority in these theologically conservative Christian spaces.
And so from his experience as an academic and a minority in these spaces, he decided to write The Color of Compromise to break down the history of how American Christianity tacitly supported, if not strengthened, institutional racism in the United States.
The book does a historical survey looking at the American church's failure, really, in so many instances to confront racism and honestly being part and parcel of the forces that constructed a caste system based on skin color. And so it's a difficult topic to address.
He starts by taking us back to the compromises early colonial Christians made when faced with the humanity of those they had enslaved, and how those decisions would shape America's attitudes towards race for centuries.
So Christian missionaries are actually saying, hey, we need to evangelize Native Americans and these Africans you're bringing over as unfree labor. And they're negotiating with the politicians and the powers that be, saying, how can we get this done? And at the same time, the planter class and the slave-owning class is saying, no, you're not going to evangelize our enslaved people, because then they're going to get all these ideas of freedom. And so it's in that mix that many Christians say, okay, how do we compromise? How do we show, and in that compromise, they're actually being complicit with, in the 17th century, is a still emerging system of advantage based on race. At the same time Christians have been complicit in racism, they have also been the ones who have most ardently fought against racism as well. But there's a couple things about that. Number one, we overestimate the number of Christians who were pushing back against the racial status quo. It was always a minority. They were always sort of the prophetic voices calling out in the wilderness, if you will. And we also underestimate the opposition they faced. So the reason why there weren't more people pushing against the racial status quo is because it was very costly. You could lose your job, you could lose your home, you could even lose your life, as was demonstrated in many cases. So even those voices of dissent get drowned out by the other voices, whether the other people, the other congregation members, or the elites who have decision-making power. And what tends to win the day throughout any particular period of American history is a tacit, if not explicit, support of racial identification and a racial hierarchy. One of the events that stuck out to me most clearly was in 1667, the Virginia Assembly, which was a group of white Anglican men, passed a law that said baptism does not confer freedom on people of African descent, Native Americans, or mixed race people. And what they're saying is they recognize implicitly that there's something liberatory about the Christian faith. so that if you baptize someone, even if they look different, talk a different language, or from a different place, there's an equality that's implicit in that baptism, that you are now spiritual brothers and sisters, and you therefore cannot treat other people as property or as simply tools for your labor and your profit. But they passed a law against that, which demonstrates the complicity of these Christian men in the political sphere in terms of race. And what also strikes me about that decision is it's in 1667, which is more than 100 years before the Declaration of Independence, more than 100 years before the ratification of the Constitution. So these issues of religion and race, and you can throw in politics there too, actually predate the political entity known as the United States.
Your book comes out at a time in which, I will say, over the last year and a half, 2 years, I am seeing in many religious traditions beyond Christianity a greater push to confront and talk about race and racism institutionally and implicitly in practice and in traditions. And I'm seeing workshops and books and stories and storytellers, and I would love your perspective on why this is happening and why this is happening now.
Great question. Why this is happening? Because there's always been resistance to racism, and there's always been people of faith pushing back against it. The Black church tradition, which has arisen in the context of first race-based chattel slavery, then institutionalized and customized exclusion through Jim Crow laws, and now through ongoing forms of systematic and institutional racism, the Black church has always been a bulwark against bigotry. And so that resistance pays off. You know, it was abolitionists who helped create a narrative against slavery, and helped to sort of support the cause of freedom. And, you know, let's not forget, it took America's bloodiest war to end the institution of race-based chattel slavery. But there were people in that war, including Black people, especially Black people, who were fighting against slavery, literally fighting against it at the risk of their lives. So it's always been the case that people have been pushing back, and what racial progress there has been is a result of this ongoing freedom struggle.
What are the institutional challenges that the church faces today, and the churches that you're looking at specifically?
There's a plethora of challenges. Some of it's educational. So if we look at our Bible colleges and seminaries, there have been recent efforts to diversify the course offerings in the curriculum, but we've got a long way to go. It is conceivable that you could go through Bible college and or seminary and really not substantively engage with any Christians or theologians of color, particularly African descended or Black people. And that's a deficit in our education, because it's not that God's unchanging word is, susceptible to the different attitudes of each generation. It's that biblical principles, eternal though they may be, have particular contexts in which they are applied. So it behooves us as believers, particularly in America, to understand how Christian believers have theologized and conceptualized the faith in the context of racial oppression. We've got to set our faces like flint, as the Bible says, and resolve that fighting racism and promoting racial justice isn't going to be an occasional thing. It's going to be an ongoing part of our lives. It's not just for Black History Month. It's not just for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's for the entire year, every day, day in and day out for years to come. And the reality is, we labor for a day that we won't see. It took us centuries to arrive where we are in terms of the racial divisions that we see in the church and beyond. It's going to take a long time to take down those walls brick by brick and promote reconciliation. But that's okay. Everything we do is a step closer in the stride toward freedom.
You speak and write about Dr. King, and Dr. King's MLK Day coming up, there are going to be a lot of stories written about him and features and discussions. There'll be days of service. I would love your thoughts on how we mark and what you would like to see happen on that day.
I think at least annually, everyone should go back and read Letter from a Birmingham Jail. It's one of the greatest works of political theology that an American Christian has ever produced. And it addresses the issue of race along two vectors. Number one, it's coming from the pen of Martin Luther King Jr. So you get the perspective of a Black Christian. But it's also important and much less recognized that he's responding to a group of white clergymen, most of them Christian, one of them Jewish, but they're local residents of Birmingham. And these are what King called the white racial moderate. And by that, he means these are not foaming at the mouth racists. These are not Ku Klux Klanners. These are not, you know, the Orville Faubuses or the Bull Connors who are you know, releasing dogs against Black protesters. These are the white people, the white Christians mainly, who are saying, yeah, we need to do something about the racial situation in America. But they're also saying we need to abide by the law, not recognizing that the laws themselves are unjust. And we need to have patience, not recognizing since at least 1619, and before that, if you include the African-descended people in Spanish Florida, Black people have been waiting for justice. And, you know, King has a book called Why We Can't Wait, where he's dealing with this because the objection comes up so much from white moderates who are saying, look, just be patient. What we don't need, what the white moderates are writing against King about, is the public protest. They're saying we don't need the marches, we don't need the boycotts, we don't need the very public spectacle of you protesting racism. Just slow down a bit and let the local Birmingham residents, because they're, you know, sort of using the outside agitator trope again, let the local Birmingham residents work through the established channels, the city council, the laws, the courts, and bring about change. And what King and other protesters are saying, listen, number one, we've been waiting already for centuries. Our patience is only godly, because only God could bring about the type of patience that people who have been enslaved and lynched and raped and segregated against for so long have demonstrated in the case of the Black freedom struggle. Secondly, those outlets that you're suggesting are actually part of the problem. You know, it's horrific that many slave owners and racists after the Civil War then become politicians and governors and lawmakers and sheriffs. And so the very people who oppressed you are now reinstated in positions of power to oppress you again. So he's saying that the people and the institution themselves are part of the problem. We can't go through these established channels. We actually have to bring about a public spectacle in order to draw attention to injustice. It's not to bring attention to ourselves. It's not to glorify this. It's to let people know, hey, this is happening and you need to pay attention. So that's what he's protesting in Letter from a Birmingham Jail.
The question that I'm curious about hearing your thoughts on is the use of the idea of civility specifically in our public discourse and in our houses of worship when debating policy or pushing for change. What is the ethos that you see being appropriated when you hear the word civility invoked around the wrestling for change?
Civility is often used in the context of extra legal protests. So, you know, protesters are breaking the law. They're not supposed to, you know, block the street or congregate in a specific spot. But it's nonviolent, too. So, you know, most of the protests that we're seeing nowadays are done by protesters who are committed to nonviolence. And that, to me, is very civil. In a sense, it's much harder to be civil during a protest than to be civil when you're working through sort of established channels, even if they're not very functional. So that's one aspect. But also civility, we have to ask who benefits when we promote the idea of civility? To whose advantage is it? Because oftentimes civility is on the side of the status quo. Civility is on the side of those in power. Are we aiding the cause of justice when we call for civility? Real justice, not just law and order, because laws can be unjust. Or are we sort of catering to our own comfort and our own definitions of what is and is not acceptable, even though we're not the ones in the position of being oppressed or marginalized.
That was Jamar Tisby. He's the author of The Color of Compromise: The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism. He's also the co-host of the podcast Passing the Mic and a PhD candidate at the University of Mississippi. We spoke in January 2019. You're listening to Inspired. I'm Amber Khan. Hey friends, this is Amber. I hope you're enjoying this week's episode of Inspired. If you value and count on this program to bring you stories that you won't hear anywhere else, I want to invite you to support our work. We do not receive any funding from NPR or its member stations. We're a nonprofit, and we are committed to fostering understanding by promoting the kind of media and information that we bring to our listeners each and every week. But we cannot do that without listener support. If you could take a moment and make a tax-deductible contribution, we would be grateful. You can visit interfaithradio.networkforgood.com and make a contribution. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. I would like to invite you to consider becoming a monthly recurring donor. It takes the stress off of us when we know we can count on you. Take care and have a wonderful week.